Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Bella and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. And the title of this program is Understanding the Different Names for Biomarker Testing and Their Role in Selecting the Best Treatment for You. And this program is done in partnership with the Molecular Pathology and Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. We are delighted to be partnering with them today. Now, and again, the title of this is Understanding the Different Names for Biomarker Testing and Their Role in Selecting the Best Treatment for You. This is part two of the two-part series, What You Need to Know Makes All the Difference in the World, in terms of biomarker testing, in terms of what you need to know about biomarkers in the treatment of cancer makes all the difference in the world. Today's program is supported by the Anna Fuller Fund, Pfizer, and an educational grant from Exact Sciences Corporation. The Anna Fuller Fund and Pfizer and an educational grant from Exact Sciences Corporation. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mark Criss. And Dr. Criss is the William and Joy Rain Chair in Thoracic Oncology, Attending Physician, Thoracic Oncology Service, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Criss will be addressing an overview of the different names for biomarker testing and why they can be helpful for treatment. Tumor marker testing, genomic profiling, genomic sequencing, molecular profiling, next generation sequencing, the relationship between biomarker testing and precision medicine, and types of biomarker tests for cancer treatment. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Criss.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today, too. This is a fairly formidable task for all the speakers today. It's a field that is vitally important, growing, and unbelievably complex, even for docs. So hang in there, everybody on the call. I'm a specialist in lung cancers, and I am going to use lung cancer as an example of the various topics that Carolyn just outlined. First and foremost in biomarkers is the pathologic examination of tumor tissue, either examination of the tissue or examination of cancer cells, histology and cytology. This is the only way in 2025 that cancer is diagnosed. You must have a biopsy and an examination of tumor tissue or tumor cells by a pathologist. It confirms not only the presence of cancer, but gives strong clues as to the site of origin of the cancer. Again, cancer that appears in the lung can be lung cancer, but also other cancers can spread to the lung, and the pathologist can help ferret that out. So the first thing in lung cancer is the type of lung cancer is first and foremost defined by the type of cell that the pathologist sees under the microscope. Approximately 70% of the cancers are adenocarcinoma. About 20% of the cancers are so-called squamous cell carcinoma, and about 10% or so are small cell lung cancer. This is the first way that cancer is categorized and the first way that doctors take information to choose treatment. I think in 2025, the next most important type of testing is molecular testing. It's got a lot of different names. I think the one people use a lot now is NGS, standing for next generation sequencing, tumor sequencing, molecular sequencing, genetic testing of cancer cells. This is all the same. And what we do here is look for the genetic makeup of the cancer cells, not your cells, not the cells you got to from your parents, not the cells you passed along to your children. And we'll be talking more about this later on. There are two ways to do this. The gold standard is testing tissue. So generally, a biopsy is obtained, and at that biopsy, sufficient tissue is obtained to do the NGS testing. The second way this can be done is by an examination of cancer DNA in the bloodstream. They call it ctDNA, circulating cell-free DNA is also used, and a lot of people call this liquid biopsy. But what it is looking at DNA found in the blood. And again, this blood comes from the cancer cell. It's not your DNA, your normal DNA, and it's not something you inherited or can pass along. A caveat there, though, is that the blood tests are about three-quarters as good as the tissue test. What I mean is if your tissue test finds a certain genetic alteration, you have about a 3 out of 4 chance of finding it in blood. So having a quote, so-called negative test in blood makes your doctor put on the table the need for other testing. The third type of testing, and again in lung cancer, the example would be the so-called PD-L1 testing, is looking at a immunohistochemical test. That is staining tumor tissue or cancer cells with an antibody. And then again, the pathologist looking at that staining under the microscope, saying whether or not this substance is present. The one most commonly done now in lung cancer is PD-L1, done in a lot of other cancers too. And it's a marker on the ability of immune drugs to effectively attack the cancer. So I'm unfortunately giving you a lot of information in the short period of time, but all these tests are very, very important. When should you do them? And the answer is the more information your doctors can have when care is planned, the better. And this biopsy should be done at this testing should be done at the time of the very initial biopsy. When lung cancer is suspected, best practice now is to get sufficient tissue for all of the types of biomarker testing I mentioned before. Histology, cytology, mutational testing, NGS sequencing, and immunohistochemistry testing like PD-L1. What's the next step in lung cancer therapy? And that is so-called staging, finding out where the cancer is in the body. And there are three general classifications of that: cancer just in the lung, cancer just in the chest, and cancer that has spread beyond the confines of the chest. That is the majority of cases in 2025. Now, the next step here has to do with the application of these testing results that we talked about. This is where precision medicine comes in, where the medicine that you use to fight your cancer is determined by these genetic tests. And so that the term precision medicine refers to that. For lung cancers now, we look for the presence of about 10 specific abnormalities in cancer genes that are distinctive for lung cancer. 5 of them, EGFR, ALK, ROS1, RET, and NTRK. There is a very potent drug available as a pill, and these drugs are given as the best therapy and given initially. For an other genetic one, KRAS G12C, standard of care today is to give our standard treatment of chemotherapy plus an immune checkpoint inhibitor, KRAS G12C. And for the others, BRAF, MET, HER2, their treatment is very individualized. The majority of people still get chemotherapy and immunotherapy, but there are situations where a targeted therapy may be the best first therapy, or if you get chemotherapy and immune therapy, the targeted therapy would follow it. That is the kind of the thing your docs have to discuss in great detail and spend a lot of time thinking about. For those patients whose tumors do not have any of those drivers, I quickly ran through the standard of care is chemotherapy plus an immune checkpoint inhibitor, obviously if those drugs are safe for the patient. Disease in the chest only, the standard today still is radiation and chemotherapy, followed by immunotherapy. If a driver is found, they could also be followed by targeted therapy. And for lung only, very complicated now. There's a move more and more for so-called neoadjuvant therapy, giving chemotherapy or a targeted therapy based on the analysis of the tumor tissue before surgery and then following it with additional therapies based on what's found at surgery. I think to summarize, I think shown you in great detail that this is complicated. And you can't do this alone. You just can't. And please don't take on that burden that you have to understand all this. You have to work with your healthcare team, and you have to put together your team, friends and family that can be listeners along with you and can help you get the information, process the information, and use it to make the best decision. And lastly, I've rattled through a lot of stuff, but what it ultimately means is when it comes to choosing your treatment, doctors have more medicines available than ever before. And all the information we have is when we give the best medicine to you up front, medicine chosen with the knowledge that we gain from the biomarker test I talked about, that will lead to the best result.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chris. That was an outstanding presentation, stellar. And actually, since you're the first speaker, you certainly set the stage for today's program, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow, and Dr. Morrow is Director, Chronic Myeloid Leukemia Program, member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor, Weill Cornell Medicine. And Dr. Morrow will be addressing, do I need biomarker testing for my cancer? Are the uses of biomarkers determining a person's cancer risk or finding cancer, biomarkers used to show if a treatment is effective or may show if cancer is returning. Biomarkers play such an important role in choosing the best treatment for you and in determining your progress. It's great, my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Morrow.
Well, thanks, Carolyn, and indeed, thank you, everyone, for joining. What a great introduction or first chapter of a complicated story from Dr. Chris. So full disclosure, I am a blood cancer physician, so I probably can give a slightly different perspective and answer some of the other questions and unfold this story of biomarkers in a little bit different way. I think going really at a very simple level, you know, and I think Dr. Chris touched on this, you know, biomarker can really almost be anything, any biologic or anything related to an organism, you know, us as human beings, that's related to cancer. So some cancers we clearly have gotten so sophisticated where one person with a certain cancer may look all the world like another person with the exact same cancer regarding who they are and what their health issues may look like and what findings look like on a scan or a blood test or anything for that matter. But the biomarker might be the crux of the question because it could differentiate a specific feature of cancer or a specific vulnerability or a specific change in many different areas, be it genetics or cellular or metabolic or otherwise. So the question, do I need a biomarker test for your cancer? Depends on the cancer you're treating. I think each cancer has its own repertoire of tests that tell us about how best to treat. But I don't want people to feel that they're driven to the quest that there must be a biomarker that's going to tell me exactly how I'm doing or exactly how to treat my cancer. As a blood cancer doctor, I'll tell you, we do have a fair bit of knowledge that goes beyond our ability to tailor treatment. For example, we We know in certain blood cancers called myeloproliferative diseases, polycythemia, thrombocytosis, myelofibrosis, these are some blood cancers people can have. These are chronic conditions, and we know, as I describe it to patients, about the switch that gets turned on, the driver, and that's often a mutation in the genetic code that drives cells. So that is a biomarker. We have the ability to test hundreds of genes, and we then try to shape our prognosis or our forecast as to how that cancer might behave and sometimes how to treat it based on a host of other features. We get a lot of direct feedback from other what I would call biomarkers directly, markers of how the blood health is, the bone marrow health is, simple things, things that come back quickly in the laboratory, things that are very easily and readily available. But sometimes we get caught up in the trying to understand and link a finding to the cancer. I often have to try to help, talk through with my patients about how we know what their blood cancer is, we know what mutation they have, and we've now found something else. And we don't know how that affects their outcome, but we can focus on the things we do know affect their outcome, the biomarkers that are intrinsic to the cancer, that are telling us how they're doing, that are telling us how they're feeling even sometimes. So we don't want to place undue extra focus on biomarkers, whereas we do really want to look for biomarkers and understand what they mean, how they impact how we treat, how we choose treatment, and how we're doing. I hope that makes sense, but I really just wanted to give two sides of the coin with regards to what information we can get. Sometimes we understand less about the things that we can see in front of us, but we've come through an era where if you look at the use of biomarkers in cancer, there really were no what we call biomarkers or the way we think of biomarkers, more sophisticated measures. Of course, doctors could understand by simple measures how a patient or how a person was doing with a treatment for any illness by looking at them, examining them, and caring for them. But the things we do in the laboratory that drive high-powered decision-making really only come into play in the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st century, and we're making huge progress. So the next question is about how a biomarker can show if a treatment is effective or show if a cancer is returning. And that's fairly intuitive, but again, I'm a blood cancer doctor, so I want to use a couple of different analogies. I treat a lot of a form of leukemia called chronic myeloid leukemia, and that is a story where it's the first human cancer linked to a genetic abnormality, which means we have a very specific, I would call biomarker, which is a genetic, a fusion or a genetic abnormality that we can test in the blood very easily. And it's ubiquitous. We can make the diagnosis. This is, we call it the Philadelphia chromosome, is the blueprints that are altered, and then the marker is called BCR-ABL. And we can measure that, and that tells us that is indeed the cancer that we're treating. It tells us that a host of treatments we have available. Now we have six medications approved, five that we can use right at diagnosis, including a newer drug called asciminib, which is remarkably effective in chronic myeloid leukemia. The biomarker is just telling us that's the cancer, that's the target. Here's the thing to shoot at the target with, or here's the thing to aim at the target, and it will work. So it's highly used. In fact, it really is the workhorse, as we call it, for the disease of CML. And it has, thank goodness for patients, replaced the need to do other more invasive tests like bone marrow tests and other studies. We can simply draw a blood test and get this biomarker or this genetic marker back, and it can tell us how we're doing. And we follow it exquisitely carefully. We have expectations for how quickly this biomarker is supposed to improve. By 3 months, it should go down 10% of its starting level. By a year or so, down to 1% or 0.1%, meaning it's 100 times or 1,000 times lower than the start. Intuitively, it can also be used if someone's able to stop treatment, and that's in a new era in chronic myeloid leukemia. Patients can actually stop their treatment under the right circumstances and be followed even more closely with this biomarker test to show if they need treatment. There's an interesting wrinkle to this story, though. So this biomarker makes the diagnosis, leads the way to telling us how a cancer is fully treated, and patients can undergo what's called a treatment-free remission. And some we call patients functionally cured when they're off treatment, and this biomarker is no longer showing the changes that we would expect that would tell us that a patient needs treatment. And intuitively, you might think that that would mean that the biomarker is gone and it never comes back and we never have to look at it again. That's not the case. In this case, the biomarker gets to low levels, and the levels are low enough where, with a tremendous amount of research, we've understood that below that level, that biomarker isn't telling us that the cancer is active anymore. It may be a bit of a background signal or a biomarker that still can be present because the cancer happened in a background or in a cell that may not cause the cancer to come back. That's complicated. So in walking people through successful treatment and then even having them through successful stopping of treatment, while I'd like to say, much like a surgeon, the cancer's out, I've taken it out, it's in the bowl, it's in the laboratory, it's out of the body, this biomarker shows us that the cancer is exquisitely controlled and by, again, a tremendous amount of research, despite the persistence of a biomarker, the cancer might not come back. So that's a story that's a little, again, giving sort of both sides of the coin, that the biomarker you'd think would be soup to nuts. It's bare, it's high, it's going down, it's minuscule, it's gone, it's never coming back, would be the expected story, but that isn't always the way it looks. So you have to talk to your doctor and understand what the biomarker might mean. Don't always assume that the biomarker means that the cancer is for sure needing certain treatment or back. And I'm using a very specific example, and I certainly wouldn't want to diminish the role of testing and the implications of a biomarker changing, but it definitely requires interpretation. Some biomarkers are observed and may not necessarily even warrant treatment. I'm not a prostate cancer physician, but you know, there's an example for men that might be on observant watch and wait approach, although they have a biomarker like PSA that might be elevated, and they may even have evidence of cancer, but surgery and radiation may be more dangerous than simply observing and making sure that the cancer isn't spreading and remains in a fairly limited form. So, again, as Dr. Chris said, this is confusing even for us, but one story I've also learned in treating blood cancers and looking at this at a global perspective is that biomarkers are tests, and I think our next chapter we're about to talk to our pathology colleagues who are such an important partner in this and get us the data and develop the tests and perfect the tests, and we work together so well. But you know, sometimes at a simple level, it's just getting access to the test, asking the question, do I need a biomarker or do I need a diagnostic test like this? How can I get one? In some places of the world, people can't afford them. In chronic myeloid leukemia, the simple test called PCR isn't always easily readily available. Or a more sophisticated form of it, where we look for mutations or alterations in the biomarker we're trying to measure, can't be done easily. Patients often have to look to their own resources to get diagnostics done. So, as a global healthcare community, hopefully we can make these tests available to all of us more readily. So, and maybe to close, they do play an important role in choosing the best treatment. They can make a diagnosis. They can lead us to the question of a diagnosis. They can lead us to a diagnosis that doesn't always require intervention. They more often lead us to a diagnosis that now we have much more correct sense of type, sensitivity to treatment, and how to treat more perfectly. And it very often determines how you're progressing, but always take information in context and ask questions, because the biomarker itself is one thing, but it has to be taken in the context of what treatments are available, how someone's feeling, how someone's doing. It doesn't always mean that we haven't had success. And I highlight my example of chronic myeloid leukemia. I have hundreds of patients who I can happily say are beyond their chronic myeloid leukemia. They're in what's called treatment-free remission. And then some of them have been off treatment for a decade. But if I look hard enough, I can still find that biomarker. But that doesn't mean that they need treatment, and statistics tell me that they may never need treatment. So I'll close at that point.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Morrow. That was a wonderful presentation. Lots of information for our participants, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Sarah Kerr, and Dr. Kerr is a pathologist. She's the chair of the Department of Pathology, Abbott Northwestern Hospital, pathologist specializing in molecular genetic pathology, gynecologic and perinatal pathology, pulmonary pathology, and cytopathology, Hospital Pathology Associates in Alena Health, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Dr. Kerr will be addressing How is biomarker testing done using samples of your cancer and your healthy cells? Samples are sent to the lab where pathologists test for certain biomarkers. Some results might lead to genetic testing, inherited or germline mutations. Some biomarker testing is done as part of clinical trials for new cancer treatments. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kerr.
Well, thanks so much, Dr. Mesner, and thanks for inviting me to be a part of this program. First, I wanted to say happy Histotechnology Professionals Day. There are laboratory professionals called histotechnologists, and we're celebrating them today. They take very good care of your small biopsy tissues, and I'll talk a little bit more about what they do to make sure that even with these very tiny little needle specimens that we have enough to do the biomarkers that you need. So first of all, I'm a pathologist. What is a pathologist? So a pathologist goes to medical school with your other doctors and then decides to specialize in laboratory testing. And so we learn how to recognize cancer cells under a microscope of all types and categorize those, and we also learn how to lead a laboratory using all these various instruments, which include some of the tests that we've talked about today for biomarkers. And as Dr. Chris had said, you know, a diagnosis, a cancer diagnosis, is really the first biomarker and the most important biomarker that drives all of the other considerations for biomarker testing. So for example, just on my desk today, looking under the microscope, I had three patients with basically identical clinical history, you know, a lung nodule and big lymph nodes in the chest. And those three patients had different diagnoses. So the first patient ended up having lung cancer, and having a diagnosis of lung cancer in a lymph node in the chest drives a certain algorithm of biomarkers that's very different from the other two patients I saw. So the second patient I saw, I think, has lymphoma, which is a sort of a type of blood cancer that involves lymph nodes. And so that diagnosis, you know, if we did the same biomarkers we did for the lung, would be totally meaningless and a waste of money and would provide very little information. And then the third patient actually didn't have cancer, had an infection called histoplasma, which is a really common sort of annoying infection that people in the Midwest tend to get and in other parts of the country, so didn't have cancer at all. And so with that biopsy, before we do any sort of other fancy biomarker testing, having a pathologist look at that tissue under a microscope and having our histotechnologists and cytotechnologists, you know, prepare that tissue very carefully, the tiny little specimens, and making sure we don't lose anything or waste anything and have the tissue available for biomarkers is really important. So when you get a small little needle biopsy of a lesion, usually it's done by a radiologist or maybe a pulmonologist or a gastroenterologist, where they're putting a little needle into the tumor and taking some out. Those cells either get, you know, sort of smeared on a slide, or they're carefully put in a wax block and cut into sections that can be applied to glass slides to look at under a microscope. The diagnosis is made first by, you know, looking at what those cells look like under a microscope, the patterns that they form, and then also looking at sort of what we would call diagnostic biomarkers or immunohistochemical stains. So some of these stains that we look at under a microscope are proteins that tell us what type of tumor it might be if we're having trouble sort of recognizing the pattern. And some of those immunostains are also biomarkers that sort of match with a specific treatment. So as was mentioned in lung cancer, PD-L1 is a very important biomarker, and we actually look at that under a microscope to tell whether or not the protein is present on the cells. There's a brown stain that we look at and try to quantify and give a score. Some other stains that we look at under a microscope that are biomarkers are like estrogen receptor or progesterone receptor in breast cancer. We apply a stain and look at those under a microscope, and sometimes we have a computer that sort of helps us count cells and figure out how intense the stain is and so forth. And we give a score that helps your doctors figure out if they can use that biomarker for a specific treatment. Another one that we look at under a microscope is called mismatch repair enzymes, and I'll talk about why that biomarker might be important for determining whether or not you might need genetic testing. So those are some types of biomarkers that we look at under a microscope. And then, as Dr. Chris had mentioned, next-generation sequencing is another type of biomarker technology that we use. And so in my laboratory, what we do is we either scrape cells that we've already looked at for diagnosis under a microscope into a tube and do the fancy next-generation sequencing biomarkers on that, or we have our histotechnologists who cut fine sections of these little biopsies onto slides, and we try to sort of dissect out where the tumor is from the normal cells to enrich the tumor, and we do the next generation sequencing that way. So, and with the next generation sequencing, what we're looking at are sort of changes in the sequence of the DNA in the tumor. Sometimes we're looking for how many copies of a gene are present, or sometimes we're looking for rearrangements in genes that cause a particular gene combination to be turned on that can be targeted with a specific therapy, as Dr. Mora mentioned, with CML, which is a type of blood cancer. And then there are other types of biomarkers that we're basically looking for proteins in the blood. So something that we can follow over time is called CA125. That's seen in some kinds of gynecologic cancer. So if your doctor knows that CA125 was being secreted by your tumor at diagnosis, they can follow that over time to try to figure out when is the best time to get imaging to see if your cancer has come back or if they could hold off based on that blood test. Dr. Morrow had mentioned PSA, prostate-specific antigen, is a marker that we can test for that's secreted by prostate cancer that can be used to either detect prostate cancer early or follow prostate cancer over time. So that's another type of serum biomarker. And, you know, something that patients often ask about and doctors ask me is, well, how come it takes so long to get these biomarkers back? Well, it kind of depends on what type of biomarker we're talking about. So some of these biomarkers, like the ones that we look at under a microscope, can just take a few days. So if I'm looking at a new lung cancer, I can order that PD-L1 stain. We do it in our laboratory. I might even get the result the same day and be able to report it out with the diagnosis. And, you know, sometimes it'll come the next day and another pathologist will look at it and score it. So those ones that we look at under the microscope are generally the fastest. But if you need something sort of more comprehensive where we don't necessarily know what we're looking for and we need to test big parts of the genome like we do with some of these next-generation sequencing assays, it takes longer because the chemistry takes a while to process on the instruments, and it takes a while for the computers to sort out what might be there and not be there, and a pathologist needs to look at the data and try to construct a report with a genetic counselor, so it's sort of a longer process. And so for some of those more comprehensive tests that you might have experienced, it can take several weeks to get a result back. So sometimes you have to be patient and wait for those results, and it's uncomfortable. And I get a lot of sort of worried doctors calling me saying, I need the result now. And, you know, we try to work together to get the result as fast as possible. But I know that the turnaround time on these tests can sometimes be stressful depending on what the test is. And then sort of another thing to be aware of is that some of these biomarkers can change with treatment. So you might get, say, a next-generation sequencing profile when you're diagnosed, say, with a blood cancer, and then down the line, your doctor wants to repeat that testing. Well, why do they want to repeat the testing? Well, sometimes with treatment, the profile of mutations can change, or there can be resistance to a treatment that you're on that can arise as a new mutation. So for example, in lung cancers with EGFR mutations, there are mutations that can arise on treatment that can sort of show your oncologist that the tumor might not respond to the current drug you're on, but they could either switch you to a different therapy or think about some other strategy. And then the last, I'll talk about two more things. The I was asked to talk about sort of how tumor testing can lead to whether or not you might need genetic testing. So what does that mean? So for example, there's a test which I talked about called mismatch repair enzymes, which is a stain we look for on tumor cells that's most commonly abnormal in, say, colorectal cancer or endometrial cancer. And when that stain is abnormal, it can tell your doctor that immunotherapy might work, sort of like we talked about with PD-L1. But it also can lead to us being suspicious that you might have an inherited cancer predisposition syndrome called Lynch syndrome. So if you have this biomarker that's abnormal, we might recommend that you see a genetic counselor to see if you have this mutation in your blood cells that you inherited from your parents and that you could pass along to your sons and daughters. And so sometimes these tests for biomarkers that we look for in your cancer can lead sort of to downstream genetic testing needs. Another example of that is for breast and ovarian cancer, the BRCA gene. Sometimes we look for those in your tumor first, and if we find that you have a mutation in one of those genes in your tumor, a genetic counselor might want to talk to you about your family history and figure out if we should be looking for that mutation as a potentially inheritable mutation. And then the last thing I was asked to talk about with you was clinical trials. So some of these biomarkers that we're doing for standard of care for your cancer potentially could match you with a clinical trial that could get you access to a new treatment that's not sort of currently available in the standard of care. And so what happens, and I see this all the time in my laboratory, we've done the local biomarker testing, and then your doctor says, oh, there's this great clinical trial that's open for you. Let's see if we can get you access to that. And so what I'll do is I'll pick out a representative block of your tumor, and I'll send it to this research study, and they'll either accept the biomarker result from our laboratory, or they might repeat it to make sure that the biomarker meets the standard that they want to match you with the drug for the clinical trial. And so it's important to know that some of these biomarkers that you're doing just for your routine cancer treatment might also open doors to matching you to some of these clinical trials that involve matching a biomarker with a new drug. So I hope I know that these biomarker topics are just a lot of information all at once, so ask a lot of questions of your doctors, and I'll turn the conference back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kerr. That was just a wonderful presentation. Wonderful to hear from a pathologist giving us all this detail, because I think many people don't realize how important a pathologist is in their treatment, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Amelia Calvarisi. And Dr. Calvarisi is Molecular Pathologist Association Staff, Section of Molecular Pathology, Laboratory Medicine, Cleveland Clinic, Member Patient Engagement Subcommittee, AMP. And Dr. Calvarisi is a pathologist, and she'll be addressing the free programs and services of the Association of Molecular Pathology, our collaborating group today. And she'll also be providing you information about how to contact their website and information to get more information from AMP. Dr. Calvarisi?
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you today. So as Carolyn said, I'm Dr. Amelia Calvarisi, and I'm a practicing molecular pathologist at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Association for Molecular Pathology, AMP, which is a nonprofit organization of around 3,000 members, many of whom are practicing physicians and molecular professionals who develop, perform, and interpret genetic testing for many human diseases, including cancer. I'm on the AMP Board of Directors, and I also serve on the AMP Professional Relations Committee and Patient Engagement Working Group. Today, I've been asked to talk to you about AMP and all of our free resources and programs for patients. As part of my work on the AMP Patient Engagement Working Group, alongside the fantastic staff at AMP, we work closely with patient advocacy groups to sponsor lunch and learns and educational workshops like this one. We also develop online resources to help patients understand their molecular testing and what happens behind the scenes in a molecular laboratory. Before I became a doctor myself, I remember thinking of the laboratory as a black box where my sample goes in one end and the result comes out the other end, often written in a complicated language that I didn't understand, and for anyone who's looked at their own molecular reports from their own cancer, you probably feel this way too. I'm the only doctor in my family, and so when my dad was diagnosed with cancer a few years ago, I got so many questions from my family, and I was very fortunate that I had the skills and expertise to interpret and translate my dad's pathology and molecular reports for him, but I know that most people don't have that luxury. So a few years ago, the AMP Patient Engagement Work Group launched a patient outreach website, outreach.amp.org, that provides educational information in a clear, easy-to-understand way. If you go to outreach.amp.org, you'll find written content, infographics, and videos about what happens in a molecular diagnostics lab, including why it can take a few weeks for a test result to be available, as Dr. Kerr was explaining. You'll also find descriptions of types of molecular tests, such as DNA sequencing, frequently asked questions, and educational resources. Specifically for cancer patients and their families, we have an infographic and accompanying short video on screening versus diagnostic testing for breast cancer available in both English and Spanish, as well as informational articles on cancer genetics, genetic testing for cancer, and disease-specific biomarkers at outreach.amp.org/resources/cancer. We invite you to look it over, and please feel free to contact us with any suggestions for additional material. With that, I'll turn the seminar back over to Carolyn. Thank you so much for this opportunity to speak about AMP's advocacy and patient resources.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Calabrese. And actually, this is such a wonderful resource. I hope that all of our participants will take advantage of it. You'll all be receiving, actually, within a week of the program, a SurveyMonkey evaluation, which is an evaluation of the program, but also will include all the resources that we mentioned during today's program, so you'll be able to have their websites, email addresses, everything that you need, so you can access that wonderful information that's available. I also just want to comment that, you know, we have over 170 participants on today's program, and you come from all over the world. And you come from both, many come from the United States, of course, but we also have international participants from Canada, Egypt, India, Kuwait, Lebanon, Oman, Pakistan, Philippines, Romania, Switzerland, Thailand, and United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call, and so amazing to have so many of you on the call today. Now, I'm just going to say a few words, actually, about cancer care services. We're going to go right into the Q&A. So I'm going to move on now to the to just saying a few words about cancer care. Cancer care is a national organization, nonprofit, that provides free programs and services to people living with cancer and their loved ones and caregivers. You can contact cancer care by calling our HOPE line at 800-813-4673 or visiting our website at www.cancercare.org. And you might wonder, well, what exactly do we offer? So we do offer free financial assistance, copay assistance, and practical assistance as well. And we also do offer a host of other services. We have online support groups. We have a lot of online support groups, and they are for every type of cancer and for both and the online support groups are for young adults, older adults, caregivers, specific types of cancer. We also do offer a pet assistance program to help people with who don't have the financial ability to have either someone to walk their dog or change the litter box. And also for getting food for their dog or cat. And we offer a host of other services. If you go to our website, you'll be able to see all the different services that we offer. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A. And I am going to ask Bella to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay, and we have a first question. This is Dr. Chris. What is the definition of advanced cancer versus metastatic? Can a person with advanced cancer qualify for tests by the Guardian 360?
Okay. So, the excellent question, and doctors really jump around with these various terms. So I think it's just important to make sure that you have clarity when you speak to your doctors and other members of the healthcare team. When you say advanced, it generally means that the cancer is not just confined to an organ, that it has either grown beyond that organ into an adjacent one, like they would call that locally advanced, or it has left the organ of where it started and gone to another organ in the body. So the cancer, in the lung, may have spread to the liver or spread to the bone. So advanced is kind of a funky term. Metastatic means it's left the site of origin and gone to another organ.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Morrow. Are there any biomarker tests for non-Hodgkin's follicular lymphoma or are being developed? So a question then for for Dr. Kerr, how often should biomarker testing be done, each recurrence, every few years?
Yeah, that's a really great question and a very individualized question. So for some cancers, like blood cancers, there's sort of standard guidelines about when we should do this minimal residual disease testing, looking to see if the biomarker is still there. For example, in lung cancer, there might be a point, you know, if you had a certain biomarker like EGFR and you were put on a certain treatment and then, you know, your cancer sort of stabilized or got better and then it looks like on imaging it's starting to grow again, that might be a good time to repeat biomarker testing to see if there's, you know, a resistance mutation there that could be potentially change what kind of treatment you're on. So it's so individualized depending on what kind of cancer you have and what you've been treated with and where in your cancer journey you are. So not a real specific answer, but know that you should ask your doctor about when repeat testing should be done in your specific situation.
Excellent. So Dr. Chris, what is the relationship between biomarkers and antibody drug conjugates?
Okay, so antibody drug conjugate refers to a very specific class of anti-cancer drugs. What these medicines are is a protein that finds its way to a cancer cell by looking for some certain characteristic, and probably the most known one is trastuzumab, the drug used in breast cancer. Breast cancer cells have on their surface the protein HER2, and this antibody trastuzumab finds and binds to HER2. And the antibody drug conjugate, in addition to the antibody finding its way to the cancer cell to that HER2 protein, which itself can inhibit the growth of those breast cancer cells, there is a chemotherapy attached. So when the antibody finds the cancer cell, attaches, and affects the growth of the cancer cell, it additionally adds in the effects of a chemotherapy drug right there into the cancer cell, antibody drug conjugate. Biomarker is just a general term for any characteristic of a cell that helps define it.
Awesome, thank you. And I'm going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways for today's program. I'll start with Dr. Chris.
Yeah, again, I'm going to end as I ended my talk before. This is really complicated. Please don't try to take this on yourself. Get all the information you can, but rely on your doctor, nurse, PA, whoever is working with you, and also get people in your family and circle of friends to be at these visits with you, to be your second set of ears, to be your scribe. Get all the information you can and use all the resources of people around you to get that information. I'd be careful of diving into the internet. There's way too much stuff out there. Get stuff that's specific to you from your healthcare team.
Excellent, thank you. And let's see, Dr. Kerr.
Yeah, the biggest takeaway I give to patients about pathology and biomarkers in general is to try to keep track of these complicated reports. You know, I see patients that, you know, maybe are snowbirds and, you know, spend their winters down south and their summers up north, and their records are completely separate, and I can't see, you know, their Arizona records. And so it's very important for me to know your diagnosis of lung cancer that was made in Arizona, and now I'm seeing a biopsy in Minnesota, and I need to know what that report said and what biomarkers were done. It's really important so that I can provide the most accurate advice in terms of what the current diagnosis is and any biomarker testing that should be done in the context of that prior diagnosis. So keep track of those records, especially if you're moving between health systems, and keep track of them, you know, for years. It can be important.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Calvarisi?
Yeah, I'd really echo Dr. Kerr's advice on keeping track of your reports digitally. If you can always bring hard copies whenever you establish care at a new practice, so that hopefully they're scanned into your online medical record for pathologists within that healthcare system to be able to review. And if you're confused about your report, then, you know, make sure to, you know, ask your doctor, ask whoever you're seeing. And in some cases, there are even pathologists who, you know, can meet with you to actually go over your slides. Not everywhere. It's kind of a growing trend and a growing practice. But, you know, if you're interested in actually seeing your cancer under a microscope, it may be possible.
Excellent. And it's a late-breaking question here. So I'm going to leave this to all of the speakers to address, but does insurance like Medicare or others pay for biomarkers? Does anyone know the answer to that?
Yeah, I can maybe take that on.
Yeah,
okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, sure, Dr. Kerr. So this is a question that I get a lot in the laboratory, is the test going to be covered? And, you know, it's very individualized to your own insurance and the healthcare system you're in and what test it is. And so a lot of healthcare systems, especially oncology centers, cancer centers, have financial navigators. Our center has one. That can sort of help you figure out, you know, what do I need to do ahead of this testing, if anything? Is the testing going to be covered? Is there an alternative test to what my doctor wants to order that would be just as good and covered? Those are some questions that they're very complicated in the current healthcare environment, but I would recommend working with a financial navigator. I know cancer care itself also has some resources that maybe Dr. Messner could mention.
That is true, that we certainly do have staff who can help with those financial questions as well. So does anyone else want to add on to that? Or okay.
The thing I would add is, so depends what biomarkers you're talking about and whether they're currently used to make a diagnosis, guide treatment, or not. Many are experimental and probably overkill at that point. and one resource that you can look at to try to learn what the standard of care is for your cancer is the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, NCCN, has some really excellent guides for patients that talks about, you know, how was my cancer diagnosed, what biomarkers are done, et cetera.
Excellent. Great plan. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank all of our participants for asking such great questions. And actually, we were not able to take all your questions just because of all the people on the call today. But I want to stress that how important it is that you ask your questions. I want to spend a little bit of time on that issue. So for those of you who were able to ask a question and got an answer that you needed, that's terrific. But also go back to your treating healthcare team, you know, with your question. And also be sure that you ask your questions. You've learned a lot from today's program. We've had wonderful speakers, and you've all asked wonderful questions. Go back to your healthcare team with your questions and keep asking questions. It's very important. So that you're as informed as possible. And if you don't get an answer the first time, ask again. Also, I just want to point out to all of you that it seems that many of you have difficulty. During the day, usually if you call an office, you can get someone to call you back. But evenings, weekends, and holidays seem to be a problem in terms of your getting answers to your questions. So please always check with your healthcare team who is available evenings, weekends, and holidays. That's really important. Again, I just want to thank everyone for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.